This is Climate to Action, a CSUSM student podcast. We amplify voices, explore solutions to the climate crisis, and confront climate injustice for all living beings. Here at C2A, we are committed to providing a variety of perspectives for addressing the climate crisis in every episode. Stay tuned for the end of the episode, where we provide simple ways you can take action yourself. First, we'd like to acknowledge that our recording studio is on the traditional territory of the Luseno Payukwicham people. CSUSM and its surrounding areas are still home to six federally recognized bands of the La Jolla, Pala, Pama, Pechanga, Rincon, and Saboba Luseno Payukwicham people. This land is also a shared space among the Kupeno, Kumeyaay, and Ipai peoples. For today's episode, we are thrilled to introduce a very special guest, CSUSM's own Dr. Elizabeth Ritter. Dr. Ritter has done a lot of fieldwork, especially in the Mediterranean Basin. She also teaches classes on campus from intro to geography to parks and protected areas. Dr. Ritter, welcome to the show. Could you start by telling our listeners a little bit about your background, your research, and how you became interested in your field of study?
Yeah, so I did not come to studying what I do directly. I, as an undergraduate, was majoring in biology, and I was wildlife biology and conservation biology focused. So I had the opportunity through my courses to spend a lot of time outdoors, to learn a lot about landscapes, the vegetation, the animals, and we had a lot of very practical hands-on sort of learning. And then I went to work for a while. So I worked in environmental consulting that I ended up hating. Sorry, everyone. It just wasn't for me, but my colleagues were really, they loved their jobs. So it wasn't for me. And I decided that I needed to find a new job or go back to grad school, figure out my life a little bit. And when I was digging around through grad school programs, I mean, I was still very interested in ecology sort of things, but I didn't really want to go into a master's degree in ecology. So what drew me to geography is that they were doing all these really interesting things and using really cool technologies to study landscape change, to look at how, the questions, sorry, that you have to hear from me all the time, of like, why is this thing here? Like, what are the conditions that led to this sort of thing? Looking for patterns and trying to understand like the evolution of the landscape or the things on it better. So that's how I got into geography specifically. And I still really thought I was a bit naive when I went to grad school. I still thought I was going to work with small mammals. Like that was still my thing. But it's very hard to do, of course, because there's lots of permitting. There's all, which makes total sense. So I was a little lost for a while, even after starting grad school. But my academic advisor, she and colleagues had been working in the Mediterranean for a long time. And so she just suggested, like, you're already doing some of this like GIS stuff, some of this stuff with remote sensing. What if you just came and looked at our site in Cyprus? Maybe something will like spark for you. And so I applied for a whole bunch of scholarships and I got told a lot, but thankfully I got told yes enough that I could pay for my airfare and transportation. And then while we were on site, since it was archaeology field school, like they housed us and did all that kind of thing. So while I was there, just seeing what they were working on and looking at this landscape and trying to envision it when the people of the past were there, it did. I was like, how can I use the skills that I have, the knowledge I have already about vegetation and about GIS and remote sensing to try to piece parts of this back together, right? Because it's always an incomplete bit of knowledge. And how can I contribute to the, I don't know, how we understand the world of the past in that way? And so it was a bit of a circuitous circular route.
Awesome. That's really interesting. And I know that there's a lot of really cool like technology that's used in GIS. I know when I was in your class, we did ESRI, and that, you know, it's a love for me personally. It's a love hate relationship, but I know it's a really, really cool way to track like geographical locations and stuff like that.
I don't think you're alone in that. Most people have kind of a love-hate relationship. There's funny memes out there about it.
Yeah, because it's like one like piece of like almost, it's almost like coding, like one thing wrong and just the whole thing like explodes, it feels like. But it's really cool once it comes together because then you feel really accomplished. I remember I was like, yes, it like actually worked.
Yeah, and it can be, it's a tool. It's not the only tool to helping us like understand these things and at least start asking questions about them.
Right.
It can be a starting point. It doesn't have to be like
the end all be all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You spoke a little bit about how you kind of started in the Mediterranean basin with your academic advisors. Can you talk a little bit more about it and the climate issues or like the geographical location and everything that surrounds it?
Yeah. So we look at human environment interactions of the past. So about 4,500 years ago to 3,000-ish years ago. And so the eastern end of the Mediterranean, this is kind of the early Bronze Age. It's still the Copper Age if you're on the western end of the Mediterranean. But we're trying to understand through archaeological excavation the things that we can link. So we things are left behind, and how can we relate those to the climate or environment of the time, essentially, and learn more about that. And then what systems did people put in place to address any environmental or climatic sort of changes, right? My dissertation was quite a bit different. It looked at modern things. So we did a whole bunch of just observational vegetation study, essentially, driving all over the island of Cyprus and just making notes. So very... very old school way of studying vegetation, and then going through some historical, recent but historical sort of accounts of vegetation as well to fill out places we couldn't go or that had changed quite a bit. And what I was doing then was using these projections of future climate changes that there's several groups that put them out. So there's one in England, there's a large group in Japan. The U.S. has their own groups that put out these global kind of climate models. And part of what they do is project to the future. So under different scenarios, what do we anticipate the future temperature precipitation might look like? So I was using their projections to see what the impacts on vegetation might be. And so we had... I don't even remember now. Several dozen species that we were really wondering, will this allow this particular species to kind of expand its geographic range, or will it cause it to shrink in some way? And if, what are those kind of, like, what does that look like? What are those patterns again look like? And there are some things that are unique to Cyprus. So there's endemic species and other species of special concern that we didn't look at them specifically. They just happened to be in our observations. And, you know, how are they going to respond, assuming that the model, you know, the future scenarios are correct, or potential scenarios are likely. And so some of the things were really kind of surprising, because we also looked at some agricultural things, because Cyprus is, olives are very important, almonds are very important, pomegranate, fig, culturally and economically, right? Pistachio, there's a few others. They don't do pistachio production, but like we do here in California, there's several kinds of pistachio that have other kind of cultural uses or historical uses. And so like for almonds, like almonds are happy. So as long as there's water, they can be provided water under future scenarios. They're like, we'll go wherever you want us, right? Some of the oak that are there are kind of like our scrub oak. They can again go lots of places and be perfectly happy under multiple kind of situations of climate. But some things that are already kind of restricted to high elevation, there's several pines, there's several oaks that are unique. They of course very much shrink. And it's not that we were like surprised so much about those things, because that's kind of what a bunch of other studies were saying about how vegetation is going to shift under climate. More so looking at it from the perspective of what information can I provide, should anybody ever look at my dissertation, that might help them maybe look at climate refugia, or how do they want to maintain populations? So for them to implement policy, I wasn't in policy, or for them to implement different conservation strategies themselves that align with other kind of management goals. And so I don't know if anybody's flown with any of that, to be honest. I hope that some of it has been a takeaway that they can work from. And then from there, my colleagues and I have continued to work together. So I still work with, which is a little bit unusual for a lot of people, I still work with my academic advisor, and we have a really nice interdisciplinary team. And so she's a paleobotanist, so studying the vegetation of the past. I work with a zooarchaeologist, so studies animal bones of the past, an archaeologist, and a geologist or geomorphologist. So she studies landscapes. So I didn't work. We've kind of cobbled together this really kind of dynamic group, but we all bring kind of a unique perspective to what we're trying to sort out about how humans and the environment work together.
Yeah.
Or in opposition.
Right. Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a together and opposition. We definitely see that very commonly now, unfortunately. One thing that kind of stood out when you were speaking about your work is how you track like species and their patterns of where they're going to go. And that kind of makes me think of like what I'm studying right now is mosquitoes and like infectious diseases and how they're with climate change, the weather patterns are changing. Do you see things like that with the species in the Mediterranean basin? Do you see them like kind of shifting? Like, for example, in Cyprus, do you see them like shifting to a new area? And if so, how could that like affect, I guess, the surrounding species? Because, of course, an ecosystem is a very interconnected web. So do you see that like happening, and like, what do you predict might happen if it does?
I mean, unfortunately, I haven't followed how they're tracking that in Cyprus. We haven't like repeated the vegetation observations or anything like that to know like what's it look like,
right,
X number of years later, mm-hmm. To see if any of that's panned out yet. But we know globally there are examples of this where vegetation is moving upslope, it's moving further north. Even in the United States, the USDA has revised its plant zones, mm-hmm. to reflect where, for gardening purposes and vegetable growing purposes, optimal locations or climate conditions under which to grow different things. So it's a well-known condition, but it's very species dependent.
Mm-hmm.
So some things have kind of a wider range of characteristics, that permit them to basically thrive under a bigger variety of like climatic conditions,
like cockroaches.
And other things are far more restrictive. And so it's hard to. What we know from the past is that there are novel ecosystems, assemblages of species, essentially, that existed that no longer exist today,
mm-hmm.
because the climate shifted in particular ways, and we either have relatives or closely related things left, or we have, you know, new kind of conglomerations of maybe things that used to not associate with one another.
Right.
And so we expect to see novel kind of ecosystems and these alliances form in the future. With plants, it's a little hard because a lot of them don't respond quickly, especially when we're talking about trees and long-lived organisms. Right, their generations extend kind of beyond the current pace of climate change. So things that can reproduce quickly and or relocate quickly, you know, we may see them kind of like adjust first. We were talking in class this week already about how we've been observing phenology changes.
Yeah.
So the patterns of like when things leaf out, migration patterns, and some things that we've been like, oh, like this migratory bird. Sorry, I don't have an example right off the top of my head.
That's okay.
We would anticipate that it would start to migrate sooner because spring is coming sooner, but they haven't.
Right.
we are starting to see like misalignments of when things like maybe bloom or there's phytoplankton, like when they first start to really like reproduce, and timing of the organisms that eat them. There are cyclical things that we know that happen, right, or random events, but that they're shifting. That the random events and the cyclical things are becoming the more regular instead of it being kind of a rare occurrence.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, pollinators are off migrating when the things they pollinate are blooming. And so we do have some examples of those things. You'll have to fact check me, but I think one of them is with saguaro cacti blooms, and there's a moth that pollinates them, and they're a little bit out of sync.
Currently.
They'll be coming out of sync here.
Oh, and that's hard, too, for, like, plants to flourish because they, you know, rely so heavily on pollinators and the pollinator, like, cycle. But kind of to switch gears here, you talked a little bit about, like, continental U.S. issues with, like, the USDA. And I know you've taught a class on national parks and protected areas because I took it with you. And lately there's been a lot of political debate around funding for national parks. What do cuts like that mean for conservation, climate resilience, or even like with the plants, like how will the species respond, anything like that?
So the staffing cuts that we've seen this year directly influence, we usually tend to think about things like, will there be anybody at the visitor center? Can they still lead tours, the trash and pickup, the trail maintenance, right? The construction crews,
right.
Fire suppression. So we usually think of those things first, which are very, very important. But along with those people who were fired or laid off, we've lost, you know, some of the veg management people, we've lost the scientists, we've lost the funding to do the monitoring that's required under different rules and regulations. So some of it is like, we may not know about some things for a while, if the data collection has kind of stopped or nobody's even there to analyze the data kind of thing. The one thing that I was recently reading about, I think it was in the Tahoe Basin, they had massive staff cuts. The Tahoe Forest, so it's not a national park, but it's under the USDA, the Forest Service. They lost people who were working on, there was some kind of algal bloom, and they had to been working with deploying these mats that basically block the sunlight, and they're having really good results.
Yeah.
But now there's nobody to do those things.
Oh no. Yep. That's so sad.
It is a little sad. You know, they can't hire students coming fresh out of college right now, or having a harder time hiring students for temporary or internship or summer positions.
Yeah.
So that makes it I don't know the right words. It basically affects the management into the future as well, because we have people who are missing out on those training opportunities and those experiential opportunities that are really formative in helping launch those kind of management conservation sorts of careers.
Yeah.
So I didn't say anything about climate, but
it's okay. It's okay.
I mean, we already know that there's impacts to our parks.
Right.
We know that visitors are adjusting like their visiting hours because it's hotter or whatever reasons. So the USDA, again, they put out a report not too long ago. I didn't write down the date. But they're timing, they're changing the timing of their trips. They're changing like the activities they participate in. They're changing like how they even like experience these open spaces, parks, the forests, all these kinds of things. So we're seeing that more people are starting to also come when the parks expect to be kind of quiet.
Yeah.
So they're shifting into the off season or the shoulder seasons when parks aren't staffed as well.
Yeah. Interesting.
So lengthening kind of the park seasons. There's more heat related illness issues, which increase cost to parks for. Of course, we have to provide medical services rightfully. When we have extreme or more regular, no longer extreme events like flooding, drought, again, it shuts down parks. It affects the infrastructure, changes the visitation patterns. I talk about visitation because those are the numbers that are easy to measure. Like at a park entrance, they're counting you, right? You have to pay a fee. You have to like check in somehow. The national forests and like the other public lands in the U.S., like the Bureau of Land Management, most of them are kind of like, they don't have like a fee gate. So it's harder to estimate their numbers and the impacts on the visitation. But the Tahoe Forest, for we know, even though they don't collect fees in the same way, with these cuts, they are small. Like this is a small region. They have more visitation than Yosemite.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And so their staffing cuts, it affects like all their ways that they can help visitors when these events may be happening or not happening, or respond to fire, respond to bark beetle outbreaks, respond to all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So it has long-term kind of impacts to the ecosystems.
Right. And that's what's crazy is that the funding doesn't even, a lot of people think, oh, it's just kind of this like surface, but you kind of spoke on how it not only impacts like, of course, jobs and job security, but it impacts our research on parks, impacts our research on with the species, with plant and animal, it impacts human health almost in a way because they're, you know, people are going at different times. And if they're not staffed with medical professional or the amount of medical professionals that they may need, then that can be an impact on human health. And so that's crazy that just what people think are just like some cuts here and there is actually, it almost seems detrimental to the park's like health and well-being.
Yeah. And the proposed budget that's currently has the government kind of shut down.
Right. Yeah.
One part of it is, so the parks represent very little of our national sort of budget.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I wanted to be accurate here, less than 1/15 of 1%.
Oh my gosh.
Of our entire federal budget goes to
crazy.
The National Park Service specifically. But there is approximately $15 of economic activity generated for every single dollar we invest in them.
Oh my God.
So the return on the dollar is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge investment.
They were already experiencing kind of staffing issues. They've had hiring freezes over the years. So they've been understaffed kind of for a while and underfunded. So since 2010, they've had a 20% reduction in staffing and then 24% on top of that just in January.
Oh my God.
But the proposals on the table right now for the budget, like this is pretty severe. So even though it's tiny, it has a big effect on what the parks can and can't do. The administration's budget for 2026 is proposing cutting about $1 billion. So $900 million reduction to park operations, which is a 31% cut. Kind of the biggest one we've seen. Part of the proposal is saying we should transfer some of these parks back to states or two states in the first place. They've never had necessarily controlled them in the first place.
Right.
States also have limited budgets, staff, and capability to take proper care of such. I'm not saying the government always takes proper care of the land, but the states may have even more limited capacity to do so. So that doesn't sound like it's going to work out so great. They are also saying, in addition to that, $73 million in construction funding. So that's like maintenance projects,
right?
As well as like future sort of needs. $77 million cut to recreation and preservation, and $197 million to historic preservation.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy.
The house is like slightly better, mildly better.
Mm-hmm.
Only $176 million they're looking to cut. So 6% of the overall budget. But they're also saying $37 million cut to construction, getting rid of the EPA budget by 23%, which again is critical to the science programs that go on in the parks.
Right.
The research, the clean water, clean air, clean all these things.
Yeah.
So that's not great. And less protection for national monuments, which are designated under, all this is designated under the Antiquities Act. So if we have less protection for those areas, that again puts them back on the slate for being open to development, mm-hmm. different kinds of development.
Right.
The Senate has a more balanced approach. They're at least not saying we should cut things, but they're not giving the parks any more money. It's a right. flat.
It's just a flat. Yeah.
Yep. So they could at least do what they're currently doing. But they have some really important sort of add-ons, I guess. Mm-hmm. So requirements. They want the administration to hire and retain staff to perform its mission. They want the administration to give Congress notice of any reorganization efforts that could cause a reduction in park staffing.
Wow.
They want to basically block any attempt to deauthorize, sell off, or transfer units out of the park system. They want to get rid of efforts to divert money from Land and Water Conservation Fund.
Oh my gosh.
And they want to require notification to Congress of any future efforts to cancel Park Service leases. And finally, they're saying that they need to double down on and force the timely delivery of grant funds for tribal and other community driven efforts that like help protect and interpret these historic resources.
Right.
So there's kind of three proposals out there right now.
Right.
None of it's moving anywhere right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's just kind of at like a, it's at a standstill right now. Yeah. It's crazy where we're at. Well, Dr. Ritter, thank you so much for taking the time to speak and educate us today. Now that we're nearing the end of our podcast, we'd like to introduce you to our tradition of offering our listeners a chance to implement something into their own lives that helps combat climate change in some small way. In other words, it's our Climate to Action podcast call to action. Dr. Ritter, throughout your work, you've emphasized the importance of collaboration and justice. What is one thing our listeners can do to contribute to climate action in their own lives today?
So I know I was asked for something fun, but because of where our current political environment is, I think it's really important that people continue to train yourselves to interpret data, to analyze and interpret data, to critically evaluate sources of information, and even like critically evaluate the text that you read around data, because we just look at it and we go, oh, numbers, that must be right.
Right.
So, and the reason I emphasize this is your climate action is because it's really sometimes easy for us to like look at a chart or a graph and again take it at face value. And not that they're using made up numbers or anything like this. It's that data can be cherry picked and misrepresented, and then the narrative around them is very convincing.
Yeah.
So being able to critically evaluate that narrative and come to your own conclusions, right? Use the skills you're developing to come to your own conclusions about that and formulate your own opinions that are data driven.
Right.
That's my call to action.
I love that. That's really interesting. So basically just look at data and being able to interpret it and analyze it in your own words and kind of being able to use that as your driving factor into going out. I really like that. It's really, really good. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. I feel that your insight on these pressing environmental topics have greatly expanded my views and hopefully our listeners' views as well, and truly opened the minds and opened our eyes to a wide variety of topics, from the Mediterranean basin and geographical locations to our national parks and what's happening on the political side of climate. It's been incredible hearing about the work you're doing, and we encourage everyone listening to check out the resources Dr. Ritter mentioned and take action in their own lives. Want to hear more from Climate to Action, a CSUSM student podcast? Be sure to check us out wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on our socials at Climate to Action. That's at Climate to Action on Instagram and at Climate the number 2 Action on TikTok. We'll be posting updates, behind the scene content, and so much more. Remember, it's never too late to start making a difference in the climate crisis. Keep learning, keep acting, and keep pushing for change. Until next time, this is Climate to Action signing off. Climate to Action is recorded at Inspiration Studios on the CSUSM campus. Our podcast is funded in part by a generous donation from the Rosemary Kramer Raitt Foundation.